It is time for the Media Beat from David Tereshchuk, his weekly review of media coverage for Robinhood Radio and exclusive to Robinhood Radio. David is a multimedia and international journalist with his own online column at themediabeat.us. And as a special correspondent since 2012, he has contributed TV reports to the PBS network, mostly on ethical issues. Here's David.
This is David Tereshchuk with the Media Beat for the weekend beginning February 23rd, 2024. Nothing activates and agitates our news media quite so much as an arch-villain riding high. I guess we nowadays have quite a few candidates for that label, but this week I have in mind former Soviet KGB officer, now President of the Russian Federation, Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin. When we scan the vast volume of current Putin-centered stories, he emerges displaying much current cause for self-satisfaction. Within days of his far-from-agile land forces finally gaining control of Avdiivka, a previously well-defended and strategically located town in eastern Ukraine, he also, one way or another, found himself rid of a significant annoyance, the bold imprisoned opposition leader Alexei Navalny. The capture of that small town cost him well over 13,000 soldiers' lives and 400 tanks. Not that he evidently cares all that much. His military draft decrees have brought him an extra supply of 280,000 conscripts in just the past 10 months, along with the age range for those drafted getting extended to now include 30-year-olds. And his military-industrial complex has been stimulated by the war into cranking out tons of replacement equipment and materiel. For instance, it's now manufacturing five times as many shells as it did at the start of the war. This in a time, we should balefully note, when the U.S. Congress has, for weeks now, stalled the supply of military aid to Ukraine, even taking a questionably earned vacation, while Ukrainian soldiers are having to limit artillery firing in order to conserve ammunition. The cost to Putin of Navalny's death in highly suspicious circumstances, hidden away in the notorious IK-3 penal colony in the Arctic Circle, is much less tangible to measure, of course. Reporting on it is as difficult as anything under Putin's iron control. Public protests are brutally suppressed as a matter of course, but Navalny's death did bring thousands of people onto the streets, managing to place flowers on the many memorials to previous victims of the regime before police moved in to arrest them and cart away all the tributes. Quietly, though, those flowers have sometimes been replaced. The new protests have been built upon the existing anti-war movement called Put Domoy, meaning the way home, led by wives, sisters, and mothers of conscripted men. It's not often reported, but every weekend they have been showing up wearing white headscarves and laying flowers on many cities' tombs of unknown soldiers. Putin's internal security forces have often been careful not to trigger wider protests by arresting or assaulting them, and instead they've employed the simpler but effective measure of harassing journalists who might cover them. Outside the country, the press has, of course, had an easier time reporting on Navalny's wife, Yulia Navalnaya, heroicizing her as previously a low-profile figure, but now a valiant widow demanding justice, addressing, for instance, the European Union's foreign ministers, the Munich Security Conference, and urging the Russian people in a videotape posted online to unite into a fist and, she said, punch hard against the Putin regime. It's curious, isn't it, to observe something about the Western media that Madame Navalnaya was relying on, that having just opened her new account with X, the former Twitter, now owned by that famous free speech advocate Elon Musk, she suddenly had the account suspended by the platform after she posted her outspoken statement. X issued a claim that it was a mistake, and she was reinstated. But as I say, it is curious. Madame Navalnaya was also the first to suggest that the regime's two-week delay it announced in releasing Navalny's body to his family was not to investigate his cause of death, as claimed, but to conceal it. to ensure, in fact, that traces of the nerve agent Novichok would dissipate from his body in that time. It was, I'm sure you'll remember, a form of Novichok that was found in his system when he was previously poisoned 4 years ago, that time when he was evacuated to Germany for medical treatment and astonishingly recovered, only to return to his eventually doomed campaigning in his home country. It goes without saying that official media in Russia tell their audience nothing of this. And the few independent journalists who are able to operate inevitably find it well-nigh impossible to directly convey to the public what they might be able to discover. Instead, they largely resort to passing the word to externally based independent websites like Medusa, based in Riga, Latvia, and Holod, based in Ukraine and in other strategically scattered bases across other European countries. These news providers manage to reach what they say are millions of individual browsers inside Russia, thanks to mirror websites, virtual private networks, VPNs, that can dodge the government censors, and hard-to-check channels like Telegram, another end-to-end encrypted means of communication. They maintain a steady supply of information that can keep the news-hungry well-fed, but whether that can translate into any real political challenge to Putin is a very uncertain matter. It's hard not to sense in these dissidents' reporting and in the correspondents' dispatches that bring all this anti-Putin news to Western audiences, I'm thinking of the BBC, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and so on, it's hard not to sense a degree of wishful thinking. We might sense even a touch of cockeyed optimism that there are real prospects for what Madame Navalnaya called her husband's beautiful Russia of the future. But I don't mean to be depressingly over-pessimistic. We can see elsewhere in Eastern Europe some precedent for overturning right-wing oppression. In immediately neighbouring Poland, for example, the new Prime Minister Donald Tusk, a Social Democrat, has replaced 8 years of hardening totalitarianism under the nationalistic right-wing Mateusz Morawiecki and his so-called Law and Justice Party. In just 3 or 4 months of the new dispensation, we've been hearing in the West, not least through reporting by America's NPR, about the dismantling of the previous national TV service, which was nothing more than a far-right propaganda machine. In its place, a genuinely journalistic news service is being built. Right down to coverage we heard that was appropriately fair and balanced of Tusk's own Minister of Culture being subject to a parliamentary no-confidence vote because of the broadcasting changes. He won the vote, by the way, and Poland's transformation continues. But Russia is undeniably a very different case. Putin has had 25 years to entrench his form of totalitarianism. Although his own signature militaristic approach could prove to be an Achilles heel, an economic Achilles heel. The Berlin-based think tank the Carnegie Russia-Eurasia Center has been arguing that Putin now faces, quote, an impossible trilemma, funding the war, maintaining living standards, and taming inflation. The war and propping up living standards both together require greater government spending, which will further fuel inflation, won't tame it, and thus economic stability will be seriously undermined. Today's announcement from the Biden administration of a whole new package of major sanctions may well help in that, and the gap between Putin's militarism and people's desire for life to get back to normal could likely only grow. Popular discontent, even anger, might finally be his undoing, though this, we have to recognize, can at most be only a long-term possibility. For now, the cost to Russians of compliance under Putin is low, and the risks of acting against him are far higher. So could that hard punch from the people that Navalny's widow called for be at all likely at any foreseeable point? Well, according to the BBC's Sarah Rainsford, the Russian people's fear and sense of powerlessness are simply too embedded. After all, she reaffirmed in her report this week, it was Alexei Navalny himself who punched hardest of all during his lifetime, and he paid a huge price for that. That correspondent knows whereof she speaks. She was expelled from Russia when her work offended Putin, and she now covers the whole of Eastern Europe from her current base in Warsaw. Her replacement in Moscow, Steve Rosenberg, is still there, filing BBC reports that steer a very careful course, always accurate, but so far not displeasing Putin too much. However, we have to remember someone else with whom I'll end this dispatch, Evan Gershkovich, another Western correspondent in Moscow. He works for the Wall Street Journal, is an American citizen of Russian emigre parentage. He's been held in Moscow's Lefortovo prison for very nearly a year now, accused of spying. His appeal against detention was, during this already eventful week, rejected. To no one's great surprise, I'd say. He is reported to be in reasonably good health for someone in Putin's prison system. Perhaps he's healthy for only one reason. A tiny droplet of possibly actual information that came during the obsequious Tucker Carlson's non-interview with Putin last week was the dictator's acknowledgement that there might be a prisoner exchange on the cards. That's all from the Media Beat this week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, David. We will talk to you next week. David can be found at themediabeat.us.